Jesse M. Dill. Mr. Jorgensen, good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you.
May I please report?
My name is John Jorgensen. I'm from the Lancaster County Public Defender's Office, and I'm here today representing Ms. Jesse Dill on her direct appeal from the conviction and sentence that was imposed in relation to her conviction for a 3A felony attempted burglary. Most importantly, the conditions concerning the fees and costs that were imposed upon her as part of the post-release supervision. As I outlined in my brief, the three primary issues that I think demonstrate our case that there was a clear abuse of discretion in imposing those fees. In the brief, I listed them in rehabilitative needs order,
improper delegation, and then thirdly, the failure to adhere to the statutory provisions. I'd kind of like to take those in reverse order today, if I may, because I really think that the failure to adhere to the statutory provision is the clearest example of how it's an abuse of discretion to impose these fees and costs upon someone who is being given a sentence of post-release supervision, because
which,
the statute says...
Which statute are you talking about?
29-2262 sub 2 sub M, I believe. Basically, which provides that the court may, as part of a probation order, and we all know at this point that anything is permissible under probation is going to be permissible for post-release supervision for any number of reasons. That's how they designed to structure this system. But that provision talks about how the court may, as part of that order, require the offender to pay for drug testing, evaluations, assessment screens, rehabilitative services, in accordance with securing treatment for that offender. But there's an important clause in there which provides if the offender has the ability to pay. In this case, there's no assessment in regards to whether or not Ms. Dill has the ability to pay. And in fact, I would put forth to you that no one being placed on post-release supervision is going to, at that time, have any ability to pay those, because we have to look at the realities of these situations. We're sending people off to prison. They're incarcerated for sometimes months, if not years on end.
And then does the statute require a hearing?
Well, I think that there has to be some sort of determination. If that hearing wants to occur at sentencing, that where you're already there, I don't know that it necessarily requires a separate hearing, but there needs to be some sort of determination.
Do you or your client have some responsibility to raise the issue with the court?
And we did. And we clearly noted in the record, we object to this fee, we object to that fee, we object to this cost, and we object to that cost because we have no ability to pay, we've been determined to be indigent, there's been no further determination in regards to that indigency, and we're going off to prison, and you're requiring this individual to be gone for months on end. When they get out, quite often people on post-release supervision, including Ms. Dill, are going to be homeless, they're going to be unemployed, they may not be without the resources, and so we have this system that's supposed to set post-release supervision, which is supposed to serve as an aid to these reintegration of these individuals, and yet that's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is when they get out and we're dropping another hammer on their head saying, okay, not only do you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this, and do this, and do this, and orders of
counsel,
do this and do that.
What evidence was presented that your client lacked the ability to pay those fees?
One, that she was already determined to be indigent and that there was no further determination.
We held that that's determination?
No, you have not. There has not been a specific order that says that once an individual is determined to be indigent, that they are no longer required to pay any sort of fees. That has not yet happened yet. But I think a finding of indigency...
What evidence was offered?
The court didn't have a hearing.
Whose responsibility is it to offer that evidence?
The court has to make a determination that there's been an ability to pay. There's been no evidence indicating that there's been an ability to pay. It's not our obligation to disprove that she has some sort of a presumptive ability to pay. There has to be a requirement, a determination that there's been an ability to pay. Nothing was offered in terms of a demonstration that she had that ability to pay.
Let me see if I can put all your answers together on how this statutory area is supposed to work in real life. You get to this point, and on behalf of your client, you believe there's no ability to pay.
Yes.
Now, did you indicate that that fact should be brought to the court by the defendant who's initiating this issue?
Well, at the sentencing hearing in Ms. Dill's case, we did object and note that she did not have the ability to pay, and there's been no further determination.
Okay. And then I was trying to listen to your answer to Justice Funk, but did you say, therefore, the burden thereafter switched to the state to show she did have ability?
Well...
Or would the defendant have the burden to show inability to pay? How does it work?
Well, I suppose that's a really good question. There is no indication that the defendant is going to have some sort of obligation to disprove some sort of ability. What the statutory language provides is that there must be a determination that the offender has ability to pay. So without any evidence that there has been any evidence to indicate that she has an ability to pay, then there's been no finding in that regard, and so there's a failure to adhere to the statute, and there's a
clear failure to adhere to the statute because there's no finding.
Yes.
Which is an answer to a different question than what I was seeking, which is how is this evidence going to proceed? And let's say it's not going to be a cumbersome event.
And it might not be. It may be very, very simple in some regards. Namely, no one on post-release supervision is going to be able to pay these fees because we're sending them off to prison. And when they get out, how are they supposed to, they're not magically somehow suddenly able to come up with all of these different fees. I mean, someone going to participate in post-release supervision is going to have a minimum of $360 assessment placed upon them just for the monthly supervision fees. Then there's the unspecified, uncertain costs of the evaluations, however many of those might be, mental health, drug, so forth, and counseling and treatment. And so we don't even know how much those particular costs are going to be. So someone getting out of prison is then going to be assessed with at least, say, $300 to $500 in fees and all these other additional costs. I think it's just a really unreasonable assumption to say, well, that they are going to presumptively have some sort of ability to pay these particular fees.
The statute doesn't have a presumption, though.
No, but there is a automatic imposition of these without any further determination, so that kind of acts as a de facto presumption in some regards.
Are there some mechanics in place for you later on in the process to contest the fees or have the fees forgiven?
And I understand that's the state's argument as to why there wasn't an abuse of discretion in the imposition of these fees in this case, because the defendant has that opportunity once they are out of prison and anywhere along the term of post-release supervision. Basically, any party, including the court itself, may set forth a hearing to re-examine any term and condition of supervision. But the problem with that is going to be, one, then you're ignoring the improper imposition of the fees in the first place, which shouldn't have happened. Secondly, the person at that point in time, later on, years after the fact, after they get out of prison, doesn't have a lawyer, may not have the knowledge or wherewithal, or even the language capabilities to seek a redress and a determination as to whether or not those fees are appropriate. So I don't think that saying that after the fact that someone can come back in and somehow attempt to redress these is adequate to determine that it's appropriate to impose the fees in the first place. Plus, there's a distinct possibility that the person may not have appropriate avenues for any sort of appeal, because if someone's on post-release supervision, they're on it for a period of time, and then they try and raise some sort of hearing to challenge the fees, and then they get an adverse decision they want to appeal to this court, for example, to, by the time that gets through the process, their post-release supervision may very well be done. And in the meantime, they're subject to incarceration and deprivation of liberty if they haven't paid those particular fees. So I think that the linchpin of the analysis really needs to be, in this particular case, that There was a clear abuse of discretion in this case with the imposition of fees and costs associated with supervision because, A, there was no hearing to determine the ability to pay. Contrary to rehabilitative needs, we need to focus post-release supervision on the rehabilitative, not punitive. We need to change our way of thinking in regards to post-release supervision and how we are handling the supervision of people who are transitioning back into the community.
Is it rehabilitative to require offenders to pay in some respects for their rehabilitation?
And that might be the case. There may be situations where someone gets out and they actually do have a steady job and things are going well for them, and we hope that that happens with all supervisees. And in which case, then the probation office, the state, or the court on its own motion can have that hearing and say, we are now going to make a determination. I'm sorry if I may finish my answer.
You may.
Thank you. Hopefully, the court would also then appoint counsel for that individual at that particular point and assist that individual with a clear demonstration as to whether or not they have an appropriate fee and any sort of an appeal of any adverse decision therefrom. And so I think that that might be an appropriate avenue to take at that point in time after the fact, if there's some determination and evaluation of that individual circumstances that that individual now has an ability to pay, to then order those costs and participate in the supervision of the process.
Do you, I know you're out of time, but do you think there's a hiccup of any sort in the statutory scheme that needs to be addressed by the legislature to be sure that appointed counsel continues to be appointed counsel when the person gets out of jail or prison and starts post-release supervision?
There's many lapses in the process, and that may very well be one, but there would be a problem with that in terms of what happens during the interim time period. Is that attorney still their attorney while they're serving their sentence? Does that attorney go on hold and then get revived upon their discharge or some sort of filing at that point? So there would be a number of issues that they would need to work out, and after the last legislative session, I don't know that I would have great faith in that kind of event occurring. So I really think it's incumbent upon the court in this particular case, with facts properly presented, to address the issue. In this one particular case, no one should be given those fees of post-release supervision.
Before you have to sit down,
yes, sir.
Are there any rules and regulations that apply to this appeal? Because I note your brief did not cite to any.
Are there any
rules or regulations that apply to the issues presented in this appeal?
Well, a lot of the statutory provisions are going to be mirrored from what's in probation. So we have to look at some regards as to what has been examined in probation. But that only gets us so far because with probation, you're maintaining an individual in the community. With post-release supervision, you're reintegrating the individual back into the community. So we have different rules and different policies for those, but I don't think that there's a specific necessary court rule that will properly address the imposition of these particular fees.
So the short answer is no, there are no applicable rules from your perspective.
To properly address this, no, I don't think there are any rules that would properly address that. So. There are no further questions. I would thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of this matter. I think it's initially improper to lump together all the costs and fees associated with the term of probation, or we'll call it probation because post-release supervision is essentially a flavor of probation, because those costs and fees are treated differently by different portions of the statute. The general probation statute, 29-2262, says the court may, as a condition of a sentence of probation, require the probationer to pay for tests, drug testing, psychological evaluations, offender assessment screens, and rehab services if such offender has the ability to pay for such services. However, 29-2262.06 is a specific statute dealing with the essentially administrative costs of probation, such as the enrollment fee and the monthly assessment fee. The monthly enrollment fee of $30 is mandatory, and I note that the statute provides no provision for a waiver of that, so that is simply a flat $30 fee that has to be imposed. If you go to subsection 4
29.2262.06, it says that the monthly programming fee of $25 per month can be waived in whole or in part if, after hearing, a determination is made that the payment of that fee would constitute an undue hardship on the offender due to limited income, employment or school status, or physical or mental handicap, and that such a waiver as shall be in effect only during such period of time as the person is incapable or unable to pay the programming fee. So I think there is a mechanism in place, at least with respect to those particular, or that particular fee.
Well, there's principles enunciated there, but what's the mechanism to affect those?
Well, I think that because they are mandatory by statute, it's the defendant's obligation to show that he or she, the payment of such a fee would be a hardship on them. And obviously there has to be, you know, this contemplates a hearing of some sort, at which they would offer, I suppose, some sort of proof of income or lack thereof, and what their, you know, income and outgo would be, and that then it would be up to the court.
What did the defendant not do here?
Everything, or anything, I guess. She objected to a number of the, like nine of the conditions of probation, but beyond that, no offer of evidence or offer of proof was made that she could or could not pay the fees, that they would be a hardship or anything. All that she did was to object to the imposition of a number of the terms of probation, including the respect to the fees and costs in this particular case.
The objection wasn't the nature of terms. It was an objection to the cost or fees. It was an objection to paying stuff. Is that right?
She objected to my recollection is she just objected to the imposition of these particular terms, one of which was the imposition of the enrollment fee and the monthly programming fee, and the chemical
test. I guess I'm saying it was clear as about money.
Yeah, right, okay. Right, yes.
Did she ask for a hearing?
No. No, she did not.
There was a pre-sentence investigation report, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
And it presumably had information bearing on the defendant's financial situation.
I would assume, I don't recall specifically what it had in it in respect to that. I would assume at least her employment status or lack thereof would have been noted. Beyond that, I don't know what all it had.
None of the briefing cites to the pre-sentence report at all, does it?
No. My recollection is that I don't remember anything specifically about her financial status in there. Seems to me it said that she was, at least at the time that she met with the probation officer, at the time the PSI was conducted, she was unemployed. Beyond that, I don't have any other specific recollection of anybody delving into basically any further into her financial status than that. There may be something in there. I'm sorry, I don't recall whether there is or not right at this moment.
Okay, thank you.
I think that the district court did, I think, what the statutes oblige it to do, and that is to impose the costs and fees, and if those become unduly burdensome or if they are simply not an option based on the defendant's financial condition, then I think there are provisions in place such that the probationer can bring to the attention of the court that I can't pay these. I don't have a job, I don't have a bank account, if I pay my rent, I can't pay the fees, something. But something has to occur. They can't just simply say, I object to this, you can't impose those, because the court certainly can impose them, and in some cases is obliged to impose them until and unless there is a reason presented to it that it cannot or should not. And none of those reasons were given in this case.
You've talked about the statutory scheme and the procedures to implement it for 29.2262.06, but I don't think you've gotten to 29.2262.2 sub M. How what's the state's position on how it's supposed to work for conditions contained in that subsection?
I think the obligation is still on the probationer to bring it to the attention of the court that he or she cannot pay those. There's no possible way. If it's not his or her obligation, then it would fall to the state to prove that they can pay it, and that's simply impossible. I mean, how am I going to do that?
And what more should Ms. Dill have done in this case if it was her position that she didn't have the ability to pay conditions contained within subsection M?
Well, part of the problem with this is that the conditions in subsection M are, I guess, somewhat speculative because we don't know at this juncture whether she's going to require all those particular tests or whatnot. It seems to me that if she wanted to object to them sort of globally, then it would be incumbent to her to A, object, which she did do, and then to say, I object because I can't pay, here's why I can't pay. Offer up something to the district court to say, you know, here are my monthly bills, here's, you know, my paycheck, or I don't have a paycheck, something. They have to give the court some reason to understand that the payment of these fees is just simply, at this point in time, not an option.
And from a procedural standpoint, what is typical is that a motion like that would be filed at the end of a probationary term to say, here are the fees that have been generated during the course of my probation, and I'm unable to pay them, or I can only pay a portion of them. Those requests for waiver of fees are usually made at the end of a probationary term, not at the beginning. Is that right?
That is, yeah. And that way the whole, and I think that's really the only way any of this makes any sense, because they have to object to it basically piecemeal as it goes along, just makes a mess of the whole procedure. I think it makes entirely more sense to wait till the end and say, okay, here's my bill, basically, for the costs and testing.
Is that you're at the end of the post-release and you may have more ability as an earner.
That's also true. And at that point, it seems to me to be the point at which the entire financial thing comes into play, because they've been supervised for a period of time and theoretically are, you know, making progress towards being a productive citizen and probably are required to either try to find or have a job as part of their probation, and that way they will be generating income and able to pay at least some of the fees. And I think to hold it off until the end of the term makes absolute sense, because they can then you will know whether they can or cannot pay some, all, or none of the fees. And you won't have to be doing this little piecemeal, nitpicky stuff all throughout the probationary period, which I think would essentially wind up detracting from both the probationer's rehabilitative process, and also it would just disrupt the entire, you know, court system, because you'd have to be having hearing after hearing after hearing after hearing every time, you know, a person was ordered to have a drug test or something and they say, oops, can't pay for that, then
I beg your pardon, do the statutes or regulations address inability to pay during the course of the post-release period to the possible detriment of the defendant? In other words, you can't pay, you won't get the test, and this program is weakened.
I'm not sure that that's addressed in the statutes or regulations. I have to say I haven't found where it's addressed. If it is in the statutes, I must have skipped over it, but I didn't see it in there.
Thank you.
But obviously, if the judge orders it and you can't pay, there are provisions in place that you can essentially apply to have some or all of it waived. And I think it's appropriate to hold that up until the end of the term, assuming it comes to full term. And
what I'm trying to reconcile is let's just assume that both the state and the defendant are rowing in the same direction, hoping for success.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay.
And I see I'm out of time, and we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do not have time for rebuttal, correct? So we will go on to the next case of the day, which is State.